audience to the end of Cinderella, because I see on your face what was on my face as I watched it this weekend, having really not seen this movie in probably 15 years. I just sat and smiled for an hour and 15 minutes. I just sat and smiled at the whole movie, because we all know the story, don't we? It's the story of the beautiful orphan girl who meets the prince, and he falls in love with her and marries her, and they live happily ever after. We have the same elements in the story of Esther, except she doesn't meet Prince Charming, she meets Prince Uncharming. And they probably don't live happily ever after. In fact, I'm not even sure that's the point of the story. The point of the story is that God is at work. God is moving through the whole story with his unseen hand of providence to make things work out, helping behind the scenes as he helps our heroine and as he helps her people. Our story does begin, though, as Cinderella's story, long, long ago and far, far away. And you may ask, exactly when is long, long ago and far, far away? Well, you remember from our lesson last week on the widow of Zarephath that the people of Israel had gone into idolatry, and that God was had brought some consequences on them. One of the consequences that he told them he would bring upon them in the law is that he would take them into captivity in foreign lands if they did not turn back to him. And that's exactly what we see happen after our story last week, before the story this week. First, the northern kingdom of Israel went into idolatry, and then the southern went into captivity, and then later on the southern kingdom of Judah was also taken into captivity. But 70 years later, according to God's promise, he opened the door and the people began to return to their homeland. The first return to Jerusalem was in 538 BC. Now, our story began in 483 BC. So 55 years have now elapsed from the time that the people first began returning to Jerusalem. And only a remnant returned at this point. Most of God's people chose to remain in the lands where they had been exiled. And as you saw in your story, Esther was one of those. Now, the events of Esther took place in the land of Persia, which is modern-day Iran. And in the biblical record, the story happens between Ezra 6 and Ezra 7, if you're reading Ezra. In that space is where the book of Esther actually fits. Now, on the back of the sheet on your table, I have put a chronology of the post-exilic events. It tells when all of the returns took place and under which Persian kings those returns happened. Gives the dates of those returns to Palestine. Now, notice King Ahasuerus on the chart. He is our Prince Uncharming. Now, you can study that later, turn back to the front, and we're going to, don't spend too much time studying that. Who was Prince Ahasuerus? What do we know about him? Well, his name is Ahasuerus is the Hebrew name for his Persian name, which I cannot even begin to pronounce, but it is spelled K-H-S-H-A-Y-A-R-S-H-A. But in the history books, you will find him called by his Greek name, Xerxes, and he is referred to as Xerxes I. He ruled for 20 years from 486 to 465 BC, and he ruled an extensive Persian empire, which you saw in the first verse of the book, and historical records confirm that to be the case. He had a summer citadel in Persepolis, and he had this winter palace in Susa, where our story occurs. Now, why do I call him Prince Uncharming? Well, I mean, he wasn't charming, but he was known as powerful, angry, and irrational. And we see hints in the text of his irrational temper and his partying. And historical sources confirm that he had fits of rage and he had wild drinking parties. And archaeologists also confirm the fact that there was a large harem at this palace in Susa. History has given us a number of stories about King Ahasuerus, and I wish I could tell you all of them, but I picked my favorite to tell you because it helps us see a glimpse of how irrational his anger was. He was a man of great vision, and he had a bridge built over the Hellespont, but not long after it was completed, a storm came, and the sea and the storm washed the bridge away, and he was so angry. He was so irrational that he sent his men with scourges and he told them to scourge the sea 300 times. And they not only were supposed to scourge the sea, but they took chained fetters and they threw them into the sea as if somehow they were going to be able to chain the ocean and make it pay for having destroyed his bridge. That part of the story is rather funny, but he also had the architects beheaded because their bridge had fallen down. So he was not a very nice man, and he was quite irrational and angry. He is certainly not Prince Charming. Let's read a little bit about him in the scripture. Here in Esther 1, let's begin with verse 3. In the third year of his reign, he provided a banquet for all his officials and his servants. The army of Persia and Media was present, as well as the nobles and the officials of the provinces. He displayed the riches of his royal glory and the splendor of his majestic greatness for a lengthy period of time, 180 days to be exact. When those days were completed, the king then provided a seven-day banquet for all the people who were present in Susa the citadel, for those of the highest standing to the most lowly. It was held in the court located in the garden of the royal palace. The appointments included linen and purple curtains hung by cords of the finest linen, purple wool on silver rings, alabaster columns, gold and silver couches displayed on a surface made of valuable stones of alabaster, mother of pearl, and mineral stone. Drinks were served in golden containers, all of which differed from one another. Royal wine was available in abundance at the king's expense. There were no restrictions on drinking, for the king had instructed all of his supervisors that they should do as everyone so desired. Queen Vashti also gave a banquet for the women in King Ahasuerus's royal palace. Now, was this a six-month party? Some of the translations sound that way, but most of the scholars I read understand that the feast at the end was a week long. But for 6 months, he showed off all of his stuff, basically, to these people. And he had a gathering. And history tells us about this gathering that he gathered all of his highest nobles and his warlords because he was planning an invasion of Greece. And the gathering was to prepare for that invasion and to make plans to invade Greece. Look at verse 10. On the seventh day, as King Ahasuerus was feeling the effects of the wine, he ordered Mehuman, Biztha, Harbona, Bigtha, Abatha, Zethor, and Carcass, the seven eunuchs who attended him, to bring Queen Vashti into the king's presence, wearing her royal high turban. He wanted to show the people and the officials her beauty, for she was very attractive. But Queen Vashti refused to come at the king's bidding conveyed through the eunuchs. Then the king became extremely angry, and his rage consumed him. This is the biblical evidence that he had extreme anger as well. He got drunk with his buddies, and he ordered the queen to come in and appear before them. Now, exactly what all he expected of her when she got there, we do not know. It would be purely speculation. But my feeling is, for her to appear at a party of a bunch of drunken men was not a good thing. I mean, imagine being in her situation. I think at the very least he was treating her as his other possessions. He'd been showing them off for 6 months, and now he was going to show her off as a possession. And you know, ladies, it's not right for our husbands, our boyfriends, any men, to treat us as possessions, to show us off as they would show off a new car or a new HDTV. We're not the possessions for men to show off. She refused. And so although we cannot be totally sure of exactly what he wanted her to do when she came, she must have felt very strongly about it because she knew these stories. She knew how his rage consumed him. And queens at that time were disposable just like other women. She knew she was risking a great deal by refusing. And so I feel like she understood this to be a very bad thing to do. Chuck Swindoll says this about her refusal. Submission does not mean that a wife is a sexual pawn in the carnal desire of her husband. It was never God's design that a wife submit to her husband's evil desire. In King Ahasuerus' case, this took the form of desiring to display her before those who would have nothing in mind but lust. What he asked was not submission, it was sexual slavery. And I applaud Queen Vashti for her courageous decision. So whatever the reason was, it absolutely infuriated Prince Uncharming. And, you know, it's interesting because research shows that a man's greatest need is to be respected. And there's no question that when she refused him in front of his little drinking buddies, he did not feel respected. Maybe there was a way she could have respected him and refused at the same time. I have no idea if there was even a way to do that. But let me just say to you, if you are ever in a position where your husband or your boss ask you to do something that you feel that God would not want you to do, or that you at least need to discuss it with him, try to show respect to him at the same time, because that's very important to a man. Her situation gives us, though, a glimpse of his attitude toward women, which I don't think was very good. He was definitely not Prince Charming. But I find the next part of the story a little bit funny. Look at verse 13. The king then inquired of the wise men who were discerners of the times, for it was the royal custom to confer with all those who were proficient in laws and legalities. And then skip down to verse 16. Memucan then replied to the king and the officials, "The wrong of Queen Vashti is not against the king alone, but against all the officials and all the people who are throughout all of the provinces of King Ahasuerus. For the matter concerning the queen will spread to all the women, leading them to treat their husbands with contempt, saying, when King Ahasuerus gave orders to bring Queen Vashti into his presence, she would not come. And this very day, the noble ladies of Persia and Media who have heard the matter concerning the queen will respond in the same way to all the royal officials, and there will be more than enough contempt and anger. If the king is so inclined, let a royal edict go forth from him, and let it be written in the laws of Persia and Media that cannot be repealed, that Vashti may not come into the presence of King Ahasuerus, and let the king convey her royalty to another who is more deserving than she. And let the king's decision, which he will enact, be disseminated throughout all his kingdom, vast though it is. Then all the women will give honor to their husbands, from the most prominent to the lowliest." Does this seem like an overreaction to you? It does to me. And the fact that they call these guys wise men is a little wrong to me. I think it's just a bunch of drunken men talking big. That's what I would say. To think that all women in the land would refuse to submit to their husbands over this, it's hard for me to understand. And I think this guy, Memucan, his wife must have sort of had an independent spirit, so he started thinking, if the king will just make a law, she will have to do what I tell her to do. So I think that was what was really behind the whole thing. But the truth is, God's unseen hand of providence was at work. God was using foolish choices, sinful acts, using the king's divorce for his purposes. Because God had a plan here. God had a need to get Esther into the situation. Now, about 4 years later, the king decided that maybe he missed Queen Vashti a little bit. Chapter 2:1, when these things had been accomplished and the rage of King Ahasuerus had diminished, he remembered Vashti and what she had done and what had been decided against her. In the intervening 4 years, he did invade Greece, and he was soundly defeated there. So he came home defeated. And I think at this point, he decided he wanted some companionship. Now, he still had a harem. There were other women there. But Vashti must have somehow been a particular comfort to him, a particular companion to him. And he realized that he actually missed having her around. Ancient historians even record the fact that this king took comfort in his harem when he returned from this defeat. So he made a decision to have the beauty contest of a sort to find the new queen. I would call it a Miss Persia pageant. And we see that here in chapter 2. Verse 2, the king's servants who attended him said, let a search be conducted in the king's behalf for attractive young women. And let the king appoint officers throughout all the provinces of his kingdom to gather all the attractive young women to Susa the citadel, to the harem under the authority of Haggai the king's eunuch who oversees the women. And let him provide whatever cosmetics they desire. Let the young woman whom the king finds most attractive become queen in place of Vashti. This seemed like a good idea to the king, so he acted accordingly. And then drop down to verse 12. At the end of the 12 months that were required for the women, when the turn of each young woman arrived to go to King Ahasuerus, for in this way they had to fulfill their time of cosmetic treatment, 6 months in oil of myrrh and 6 months in perfume and various ointments used by women, the woman would go to the king in the following way. Whatever she asked for would be provided for her to take with her from the harem to the royal palace. In the evening she went, and in the morning she returned to a separate part of the harem under the authority of Shagaz, the king's eunuch, who was overseeing the concubines. She would not go back to the king unless the king was pleased with her, and she was requested by name. The winner of this pageant was determined by her beauty and her night in bed with the king. And you already know this pageant was won by a young, beautiful Jewish woman named Esther. Her name, Esther, is the Persian word for star, but it is related to the goddess Ishtar's name, and she was the local deity in Persia. Her Hebrew name means myrtle, and apparently it was common in that day for Jews who were living long, long distances from their homeland to not only have a Jewish name, but to adopt a secular name that would have been part of the local culture as well. And that's what we see here. We see here in 2:5-8 that Esther was an orphan and she was raised by her cousin Mordecai. And he clearly loved her. He clearly cared for her. You see that throughout the book. 2:21 says that Mordecai had an influential position in the government. We don't know if he had that at this point or if it was only later after Esther became the queen. A Persian name is all we have for Mordecai, and his name is related to the name of the Babylonian god Marduk, and his name is related to that. Mordecai's great-grandfather, Kish, was apparently one of the ones taken captive from Judah by the Babylonian king Nebuchadnezzar, when he also took the Judean king Jeconiah captive as well. That took place in 597 B.C. Now, 597 B.C. was 117 years before this story. So in some of the translations, it's unclear, but it was not Mordecai who was taken captive. It was his great-grandfather, Kish. Mordecai would have been born in this land. He would have lived here his entire life. Now, how did Esther get in this beauty pageant? And there is a lot of difference of opinion about Mordecai and Esther and how she actually ended up in this. There are some different perspectives. There are many who condemn her and Mordecai because the Jewish leaders had called the people to return to Jerusalem and they had not gone with the people. They're criticized for living not only in the world, but of the world. And it's true that they have names that involve foreign deities, but I would certainly blame their parents more than I would blame them for their names. And we also know that Mordecai told Esther to hide her Jewish heritage in the harem, and that means she would have had to forgo some of the dietary restrictions there. So there are some reasons that people criticize them. But my personal feeling is that Esther was a very, very young woman here. She was probably no more than 20 years old at the very oldest. And she looked to her guardian Mordecai for advice. We see that all the way through the book. She looked to his counsel. And I don't think there was any choice here. Gathering all the beautiful young virgins was the king's edict. He sent somebody to find them and bring them back. He didn't say, gather the women who want to come, let them decide to be in the contest. He said, go out and get the beautiful young women and bring them to me. And women in that day were really not much higher than slaves. And I don't believe Esther had any choice in the matter. I believe that she had to go into the king's harem. But there probably were some fears involved, particularly in Mordecai's mind. We know he was afraid for her to tell them in the harem that she was Jewish. But despite the fears, Esther is seen as not only beautiful outwardly, but beautiful inwardly. She was characterized by humility and grace. Beginning in verse 9, we'll back up a little bit. Verse 9 of chapter 2, it says, the young woman pleased him, and she found favor with him. He quickly provided her with her cosmetics and her rations. He also provided her with the 7 special young women who were from the palace. He then transferred her and her young women to the best part of the harem. Now, Esther had not disclosed her people or her lineage, for Mordecai had instructed her not to do so. And day after day, Mordecai used to walk back and forth in front of the court of the harem in order to learn how Esther was doing and what might happen to her. At the end of the 12 months that were required for the women, 15, go to 15. When it became the turn of Esther, daughter of Abihail, the uncle of Mordecai, who had raised her as if she were his own daughter, to go to the king, she did not request anything for except what Haggai, the king's eunuch, who was overseer of the women, had recommended. Yet Esther met with the approval of all who saw her. Then Esther was taken to King Ahasuerus at his royal residence in the 10th month, that is the month of Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign. And the king loved Esther more than all the other women, and she met with his loving approval more than all the other young women. So he placed the royal high turban on her head and appointed her queen in place of Vashti. Then the king prepared a large banquet for all his officials and his servants. It was actually Esther's banquet. He also set aside a holiday for the provinces, and he provided for offerings at the king's expense. We see her humility here as she continued to obey what Mordecai told her to do. And we see that she was teachable and open to what Haggai the eunuch, who was over all the women, told her to do. It shows a great deal of humility that she was willing to listen to these other people's advice and the counsel of other people in her life. And she must have been a gracious woman as well, because in 2:15 it says, Esther met with the approval of all who saw her. Now, I want us to imagine life in this harem for just a few minutes. The women there all wanted to become the queen. Now, the queen's life was not really so great as we read about later in the book, but I think it beat living in the harem with these hundreds of women, isolated from the rest of the world for the rest of your life. And let me just say personally that 12 months at a spa sounds very enticing. But the more I thought about it, the more I thought how boring it would be that every single day you were doing the same thing. So, I feel very sorry for these ladies. But God's hand of providence was at work even there in the harem. Because while the women were together preparing to meet the king, preparing with all their cosmetics, Esther became the teacher's pet. The eunuch in charge took a special liking to her. He gave her some special women to help her, and he put her in the very best part of the harem. Now, I have heard stories of how competitive beauty pageants are, and how much backstabbing goes on, and how much jealousy is involved. I imagine there was some of this in this group. After all, these are sinful young women, and jealousy is part of our human nature. But God says that Esther met with approval with everyone who met her. These other women, despite the fact that Esther was granted special privileges, that Esther was given the very best place to live, that she was the teacher's pet, she must have had a very gracious spirit for them to approve of her in the midst of that. I would say that Esther was Miss Congeniality in the pageant. Everyone loved her. She had humility and grace. All the time that this was going on, God's unseen hand of providence was at work because he was bringing Esther to the place where he needed her to be for his plans and for his purposes. And that will be the rest of our story. We will see more and more that God's unseen hand of providence was at work in this story as it is today in all things. What we might consider lucky or coincidence or random is not. It is God at work. God is sovereign. The word sovereign has the word reign at its root. It means he reigns over all. He is in control of all things. God did not just create the universe and then just hand it over to random events. He stays in control of his creation. The word providence comes from a Latin word, providio, P-R-O-V-I-D-E-O, which literally means I see it beforehand. You see the word video in it. I see it beforehand. And so it has the root meaning of foresight. You see it before it happens. But it came to mean not only the fact of seeing it, but doing something about it. You see what's going to happen, and so you act on what you see. And that's what we know about God. God can see what will happen before it happens. God has the power to do something about what he can see with his foresight. The book of Esther is about a crisis situation for the Jewish people. A Holocaust was about to happen. They were about to be wiped out, but God, in his foresight, acted behind the scenes with his hand of providence. J. Sidlow Baxter said this: the crisis is providentially anticipated and then providentially overruled just at the crucial moment. No miraculous intervention is resorted to. All the happenings recorded are the outworking of circumstances in their natural sequence. Yet while there is no miracle recorded, the whole thing in its ultimate meaning is a mighty miracle. The non-miraculous events as to bring about a predetermined outcome. And this miracle is all the more miraculous just because it achieves the predetermined outcome without the need for using miracles. God was at work behind the scenes. God raised up Esther for such a time as this. Although God's name is not mentioned in the book, he is obviously the one to whom Mordecai refers when he says, "You come to the kingdom for such a time as this." God is the one who has raised her up. Now, not only did God work providentially in Esther's situation, but he is sovereignly at work today, using our choices to implement his plans and purposes. Just as we see in Esther, he used the people's own choices, but he worked behind the scenes for his plans and his purposes. And we're going to look at some verses that reveal the sovereignty and the power of God. I like what Irving Jensen said about God's sovereignty. He says, "God's sovereignty includes the good things he effectively wills and the evil things he permits." So even the evil choices, the foolish things that we do, work into God's plan as we see happen in the book of Esther. Now, the first verses on your sheet about God's sovereignty are in 1 Samuel 2. And we won't read them together because we've already studied these verses. We studied them when we studied Hannah. These verses come from Hannah's Song of Praise, where she extols God and says that He is the one who raises people up, and He is the one who brings people down. He is the one who makes alive, and He is the one who kills. So you may want to go back and look at those verses again, because they deal with the sovereignty of God. But I do want us to look together at Daniel 4. Daniel 4, 17. This announcement is by the decree of the sentinels. The decision is by the pronouncement of the Holy One, so that those who are alive may understand that the Most High has authority over human kingdoms, and He bestows them on whomever He wishes. He establishes over them even the lowliest of human beings. Sort of a picture of Esther. God decides who He raises up. And then in chapter 4, 34 and 35, but at the end of the appointed time, I, Nebuchadnezzar, looked up toward heaven, and my sanity returned to me. I extolled the Most High, and I praised and glorified the One who lives forever. For His authority is an everlasting authority, and His kingdom extends from one generation to the next. All the inhabitants of the earth are regarded as nothing. He does whatever He wishes with the army of heaven and with those who inhabit the earth. No one slaps his hand and says to him, "What have you done?" Daniel talks here about God's sovereignty, that He rules the armies of heaven and the inhabitants of the earth, and we cannot stop God's plan from moving forward, that He is sovereignly in control of all things. And this whole book is an example of that. This whole book shows us that God is working in all of life behind the scenes, and we see several things about what God is doing. He's drawing people to Himself, He is fulfilling His kingdom purposes, and He is bringing Himself glory as He works sovereignly and providentially. Ephesians 2, 8 through 10 says, "For by grace you are saved through faith, and this is not from yourselves, it is the gift of God. It is not from works, so that no one can boast. For we are His workmanship, having been created in Christ Jesus for good works that God prepared beforehand, so we may do them." These verses tell us that God is working. He is working to give us the faith that we need to trust Him, but He will also draw us closer to Himself each and every day through His providential work in our lives. We also see that He is working in us that we might fulfill those very works that He has planned beforehand for each of us to do. Just as He planned beforehand that Esther might walk in these works, that Esther might be part of His plan for the Jewish people, He has plans for each and every one of us. He has works and purposes that we are to accomplish, and God is working behind the scenes that He might bring those to fulfillment. Romans 8, 28 and 29. I think I read this every week. "And we know that all things work together for good for those who love God, who are called according to His purpose, because those whom He foreknew, He also predestined to become conformed to the image of His Son, that His Son would be the firstborn among many brothers and sisters." God is working in all these things, good and bad, but He is bringing them to good that we might glorify Him by looking like Jesus. God is providentially working in your life and mine to make us more like Christ, that we bring God glory. Now, I don't know what's going on in your life right now, but I expect that you have at least one unfinished story in your life. And I know in our groups in the past, there have been times on our share nights where we've shared unfinished stories. These are stories that something is happening in our lives and we're in the middle of it. And we can't see how the story is going to end in this point. The story is unfinished. But whatever is happening in your unfinished story today, you can know that God is providentially working behind the scenes, even when you cannot see what He is doing. He does not slumber or sleep. He is constantly working. And He, because He has complete foreknowledge, He can work all these things together for good. He can work all these things that we look like Jesus. He works all these things that we might be drawn closer to Him. And His hand is invisible to us. We cannot always see what's happening. In Esther's story, the Jews had no idea that God was busy working behind the scenes to fix the problem. When it isn't a Cinderella ending, as it usually isn't, we can know that God has been at work and He will still use those things to draw us to Himself, to bring Himself the glory, and to fulfill His plans and His kingdom purposes in the world. As I look back on my life, I can see that God was behind the scenes. But it's not as I look ahead that I can see it. Right now, in the middle of my unfinished stories, I can't necessarily tell you what God is doing. It's when you get to the end and you look back. You can see God's providential work. And that's the way my life is. I can look back. And, of course, I have the advantage of many years of looking back. And I can see that God has been at work providentially, even when I didn't know what He was doing. After teaching for school for 3 years after college, and hating not only every day, but every moment of doing that, I decided I had to get out of the teaching profession. So I went to law school. And after I had gone to law school for a couple of years, I had 30 hours left, I took some time off from law school and I had my daughter, Lindsay. And while I was home with her, my husband, Gary, was offered a really good position out in West Texas. And we felt that he really needed to take this opportunity. So we moved to Odessa, where there is no law school. So I never finished law school. As I look back on that now, I can see that God's hand was working providentially in my life. Those years in Odessa were the years when I really learned much more about prayer than I knew before. I learned to pray with other women. I began to serve in my church for the first time, working with other women in the women's ministry. I also was able to really put a lot of time into the lives of my preschool children. But overall, if God had not taken us to Odessa, I would have finished law school. And I would be practicing law today. And there's nothing wrong with practicing law. The problem was God had something else for me. And I can look back and say, I wouldn't be here today if God had not, at that very time, taken us away from that opportunity for me to make a bunch of money and taken me and put me in a whole different environment with a whole different group of people and turned my focus on Him and away from what my focus was at the time. It was God's hand of providence moving in our lives. And so I just would encourage you that whatever your situation, if you cannot see what God is doing, just believe that He's moving and trust where He's taking you and know that He will use it. And as you look back on it someday, you'll be able to see and trace God's hand of providence in your life. Let's pray. Father, I know that this is really easier said than done. And as I think about some unfinished stories in my life right now, it is a struggle to trust that You're doing something when I can't see it. And even with years of knowing that You have done that, my faith is so small. And so forgive me, Lord, for my unbelief and give me the faith that I need. And I pray that for all of us. When we're in the middle of the unfinished story and we can't really trace Your hand, give us the faith that we need to trust in Your promises, in Your goodness, in Your character. And Father, in the end, we'll give You the glory for what You do. In Jesus' name, amen. I think we have a couple of announcements.